We could be accused of being deliberately schmoozy for beginning with mention of our own Chris Cruzy. But after his journey, there was no other choice, because this guy from Barron made us proud on The Voice. Welcome to Spectrum West, everybody. We were in contact with Mr. Cruzy yesterday, but his schedule and traveling kept us from making any other contact other than texting. We will be talking at a later date after all the commotion has subsided to get his reflection on an experience that took a big chunk out of his 2018. In the meantime, we're happy to bring you a conversation this week with Grammy winner Bill Miller, who grew up in Wisconsin and gets back here as often as he can. One such visit was nearly 3 weeks ago at the taping of the Big River Radio Wave Holiday Show, which can be heard all across Wisconsin next week right here on Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll be introducing Catherine Thomas as well this week. She's making a name for herself as a willing participant in many things WPR. And this week she handles some dialogue with Emily Anderson, Eau Claire City Council person, educator, and author. They'll discuss her new book, 15 and Change. But first, you know Tim Harmston from his many guest shots on the aforementioned Big River Radio Wave. Appearances at regional venues and on national television programs. And maybe you know Tim Harmston because he's also from your hometown of Menominee, Wisconsin. Well, this huge comedic talent is lending that talent and thus support to the Dunn County Humane Society, headlining a night of comedy next weekend in Menominee. He stopped by during a busy media day earlier this week. So before we move on to the topic at hand, let's talk about Tim's trials and tribulations. Give the audience an inkling. Yes. I love the term inkling. Somewhere along the line, someone should tell us what an inkling is. What is the equivalent of an inkling?
Well, I've had a hankering to use the word inkling.
Have you?
Yes.
How about hankering? With an apostrophe. Maybe inkling.
Yeah, inkling. Just shorten it up a little bit.
Give the audience an idea of what life of a stand-up comedian is.
Well, let me just say that this is my 17th year of performing stand-up comedy, which I don't
get. I couldn't have guessed that.
I don't get that.
Wow.
And I've been a professional for about 10 years now. It took me 7 years to get to where I could make a dollar doing it.
Okay.
My career has sort of evolved to the point where now I do a lot of non-comedy club shows. I did a lot of comedy club shows for almost a decade, and now I'm doing some theaters, performing arts centers.
Corporate stuff.
Corporate shows, holiday events. I did the Minnesota State Fair this year, and then I did a fair in Iowa, which was an eye-opener. And so it kind of evolved into where if you have comedy where it's appropriate for all ages, you can broaden your horizons. And so I've done that a little bit. But I love doing, my favorite thing still is doing comedy clubs because I can truly be myself and really let loose and talk about whatever I want to talk about.
So that's more spontaneous, comedy clubs?
Yeah, I think there's a liberation of being in a comedy club, in the dark, dank basement where nobody has an inkling. You have a bell that you could hit for that?
I like that. Thank you for using that. I'm bringing it back and you're helping me.
I'm stealing it from you. But I like being in the basement. I like the New York dark club, candlelight on the tables, you know, where you can really explore the inner workings of your mind. So I try to schedule enough between all the casinos and corporate shows and things that I do. I try to every 2 or 3 months have a comedy date at a club where I can kind of dig deeper and find out what's in my brain. So
does that kind of lend itself to the audience? As I was hearing you describe comedy clubs, the dark and the dank, does a comedian play on what he or she expects the audience is expecting? Is it all about expectations?
Because
comedy clubs are where people come to just let their air down, and other places it's almost like they're challenging you to make them laugh.
Yeah, and there's a difference between doing a company holiday party where a lot of people maybe don't want to be there. you know, they got dragged there by a partner or spouse or whatever. And then there's a comedy club where most people, when they go to a comedy club, they, you know, they buy tickets and they go, and they go with an expectation that they're going to be challenged a little bit. The truth of it is that when you're not a famous name, like if you're not a giant Seinfeld level comedian, the people that go to the comedy club may not even know who you are, not know what to expect. There's a real thrill in that. They're basically saying, we don't know who you are, but we trust you're going to make me laugh. And then I'm saying, I know you don't know who I am, and I'm going to try to make you laugh. And if you accomplish it, there's a reward to it. So that's why I always want to have certain comedy club dates on the calendar.
You're kind of alluding to an evolution. Do you feel like there should be an evolution? Comedians take their comedy to bigger stages. You've talked about that.
Yeah.
They take it to film. They take it to documentary. They're on YouTube a lot. Situation comedies.
Podcast.
More writing for other people than anything else. If you're writing for other people, that means you've kind of arrived. And here's the segue I want to make about that. The job security or lack of it in the comedy world. Because most people look at the future through the eyes of their jobs, you know, advancement and pay raises and benefits. First, does a comedian look at what he or she does as a job, or is it just who they are? And secondly, do you look down the road? And if you do, what do you imagine?
Food delivery.
Down the road, yeah. I get that. Okay.
The reality is for me, I started in the film production business
when I was
19 years old. And by the time I was 22, I was an art department assistant and a prop master and an art director. I did that for 12 years. That's freelance. You know, film production is 99% freelance. So, and then I kind of segued into stand-up comedy while I was doing the film work and stuff. And so being self-employed is all I know. I've never had a steady paycheck. And there are times where I'm like, well, I wish I could really have the security of a paycheck and the benefits and all that stuff. But I feel like I'm this far, I might as well just keep going with what I like to do because life is short. So I don't really look too far down the road. I look at my calendar and I just kind of map it out in my brain. What do I want to do and what gigs would I like to do this year that I haven't done? And, you know, the Minnesota State Fair was a real big accomplishment for me because that's an honor, I think, to be able to, you know, be on that calendar.
So do you and an agent sit down and say, I'm ready for this, get me that?
That's part of it.
Okay.
You know, it's not always possible, but you kind of you got to have goals.
Yes, and I'm glad to hear that you do. But, you know, the chronology that you just gave me, you don't look half as old as what the years that you've just told me about. I mean, all those years of film production, and now you've had how many years as a stand-up comedian?
Well, 17.
Yeah, well, how old are you? You're about 80.
89. 89.
In the studio with Tim Harmston. And we've been talking about other things, and we're going to get to the topic at hand, which is a benefit that he's doing for the Humane Society of Dunn County. It's coming up Saturday, December 29th. But first, I have just one other short little item of business that I've felt bad about for about 6 years now. In a conversation I had a few years ago with Louis Anderson. Oh, yes, you know Tim and Mary. I said, yeah, I know Tim and Mary. And he said, oh, I couldn't make it to their wedding. I had a gig and blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, I was at their wedding. And he said, oh, I saw the pictures. And I said, well, Louis, here's your opportunity to say something to them.
Mary, Tim, I'm so happy that you got to have a beautiful wedding. I saw the pictures, some of them. It looked like a spectacular view. And, you know, it couldn't happen to two nicer people. They're just terrific people, super funny, super nice, really good, you know. It's why the Midwest means so much to me, are exactly people like Mary and Tim.
Huh? Oh, geez. Wow, I'm going to get all sentimental on the show.
That. And that's a number of years ago, and I've told you how many times I have this greeting from Louis, and I'm going to send it to you, and I've never sent it to you.
Wow. Wow, that is so cool. Louis has just been such a wonderful influence on all comics. I mean, I mean that in a broad sense.
Louis is a broad sense.
Yeah, he has a footprint on our comedy scene in Minnesota amazingly profound. And I just when I started to do comedy, I would say too many words. You know, comedy's about words. If you have too many words, you're not going to be funny because the audience is waiting for you to get to a punchline. And so I started watching the greats, and I put on some Louis Anderson when he was on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. And I was like, he doesn't use any words. Like, he accomplishes his whole joke with just a minimum amount of words. And every young comic could stand to watch Louis and learn how to write and perform. And wow, that really meant a lot.
Within our conversation, he talked about doing jokes or adjusting jokes on the fly. He told me about one joke that he told for the longest time. And then he, one night, just spontaneously came up with a punchline that was completely different than what he had been using, realized that he had finally got it.
Yeah, it's elusive. Yeah, it's elusive. There are things in my notebook that I wrote 15 years ago that I know are funny, but I just haven't been able to find the right combination words. And then sometime you'll be on stage and it'll just fly into your brain like a pelican dropping a joke baby into your
laptop. That's a good vision.
Yeah, I don't know if that, but yeah, it is true. It does.
It's a stork, actually.
It's
not a pelican. Of course, wow. In your world, it could be a pelican.
Yeah, right. Well, let's change that. It's a pelican now.
Saturday, December 29th, Guffaws for Paws, an evening of stand-up comedy to benefit the Dunn County Humane Society. Where is this?
This will be at the Stout Ale House. Yeah. It's a very cool place. It's a giant room. They've done a lot of comedy in there, and they can accommodate hundreds of people, and we're gonna try to pack it in as much as possible. And I've got two wonderful comics coming with me. Brian Miller is just I think he's the best writer in the Twin Cities. And Wendy Mayberry, who's a Southern transplant, she's from Georgia, moved to.
She talk funny?
She does have a drawl.
Okay.
Yeah. And she's just, I've been wanting to work with her for a long time. And so this is a great opportunity to, I like introducing funny people that I like to the people that come out to see me because I feel like I know what people will enjoy. And so Brian and Wendy are great. And so the three of us are going to put on a show. It's going to be about an hour and a half or 2 hours long, and it'll be a lot of fun.
I saw a quick video by Brian in which he said he grew up in a funeral home.
Yeah.
First member of his family not to become a mortician. Wow, now there's a comedy foundation for
him. Yeah, he talks about that. And he's actually from the South, or Southern Illinois, way down south.
Oh, okay.
But and then he lived in Kentucky. You know, it's fun to see people from the South come to the North and observe.
And Wendy Mayberry has a funny website, and I thought that's a good sign.
Yeah, right.
How did this all start? First of all, I know that you have a dog, and it's a well-traveled dog. Was it your idea?
Well, it's to be honest, like it all kind of came together from a couple different angles. One, I did a fundraiser-type show in Dunn County a year ago, and that was fun. We were able to draw some people and help raise some money for the Historical Society. And then I thought, if we can raise money, let's do something,
sure.
You know? And so I had a friend who works at the Humane Society, and she kind of mentioned it. And then I got a dog. We got the dog from a Humane Society in the Twin Cities, and I had never been a dog person, but then I realized the power of dogs. They not only help heal people or comfort people, they bring people together, because I would go to the dog park out by the Humane Society in Menominee when I would visit my mom. I'd bring Dingo out there. I would meet people. So you're walking around a dog park and you're talking to people. In this day and age, like, any reason for people to come together and communicate is a positive. And so I realized that dogs are really the greatest thing ever. And I became a dog person overnight. So any chance to help dogs... I went to the Humane Society a couple days ago to pick up some flyers to kind of put up around town. Mm-hmm. And I looked at the wall of dogs and their biographies, you know, the ones that you can adopt, you know. And it's just like, it's very powerful, because these dogs, they need homes. They say it's a cliche, but like, if you get a dog that's from a shelter, they appreciate you more. And I truly believe that. Like, Dingo really... He loves it. He's been on stage. He's a performing dog now. He does.
Cool.
He does.
If only Ed Sullivan were still around.
He's done some time on a couple shows. he's great. He's changed our lives for the better. So I just want to help some animals.
Are the Humane Society people going to have photographs there that night so that people who are dogless can say, I'd like to have that dog right
That's
there?
That's a great idea. I don't know. I haven't talked to them about
they
that.
They should have a board that shows available animals.
Gosh, we're solving problems here. That's a great idea.
It's the least I can do for you.
Yeah, thanks.
Any chance that this performance is dog friendly?
I don't think so.
No. The alehouse might not appreciate
yeah. I think there's certain restrictions against dogs and in that type of environment.
Okay.
But maybe I should mention or describe some of the dogs that are available, because I did see the entire wall and there's some beautiful animals.
How good would you feel if after that night there was a plethora of animals adopted because you cared enough?
Yeah, I would love that. I'm going to look into that.
Always a pleasure, Tim. Thanks, and happy holidays.
Thanks. Happy holidays, Al. Thanks for having me.
And remember, that's December 29th in Menominee. Tickets available online by clicking on the Events tab at DunnCountyHumaneSociety.org. This is Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Support for WPR comes from Marquardt Toyota, dedicated to providing an enjoyable and stress-free buying process with welcoming facilities. Located off Highway 53 between Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls, or at MarquardtToyota.com. Well, Jim Oliver has taken some holiday time for himself this week, and we're pleased to welcome a new perspective from special correspondent Catherine Thomas. She provides a whole bunch of behind-the-scenes support around here, including helping produce Rich Kramer's weekly Monday discussion, The West Side. Catherine is a young adult, although claiming to reside on the far reaches of that category, but when a young adult novel was released by an Eau Claire author, we asked if she would file a report, and in true form that we've come to appreciate, she consented.
Do you know Max Howard? You just might, even if that name doesn't ring a bell. Max Howard is the pen name of Eau Claire author and City Councilwoman Emily Anderson. Today she tells us about her new book, 15 and Change, which was released this past October by West 44 Books. Emily Anderson, a.k.a. Max Howard, thanks for spending some time with Spectrum West.
Well, thanks for having me.
Why don't we get started talking a little bit about your background? I know that you are a Wisconsin native, just like the main character in your book, Zeke, in 15 and Change, and that you're from Eau Claire as well, but that you have spent some time elsewhere learning and teaching. Tell us about your development as an author and the path that took you from Eau Claire and then back to it.
Sure. Well, I've always been writing ever since I was really small. I was really lucky to grow up in Eau Claire because I had opportunities to explore my curiosity and my interests. I spent a lot of time at the Chippewa Valley Museum. I think because I was always interested in imagining what life was like in the past or what life was like for other people. So Eau Claire was a great place to grow up. And then I went to college in the Twin Cities at McAllister College, and I studied English and anthropology, and kind of continued those interests of like, okay, how do we talk about what life is like for other people, or how do you describe your own experiences? And I worked as a high school teacher for a while, and I went and got a PhD in English. And something that I kept observing was that it's important to talk about the way that we live and the conditions that we face in our lives and the opportunities that we have in our lives, because stories are how we understand the world, but they're also how we change it. And so I guess through my journey, I just began to see the importance of stories, both from an entertainment perspective, but from a really necessary perspective of how we understand ourselves as a community and as a country and as families, as individuals. All the ways that we understand ourselves as groups are through stories.
I like that a lot. It makes me think of the pantheon of authors that you are now part of who use their writing for social change. Well, I guess we could start with the name of the book, 15 and Change. It's also written under a pen name. When I first saw Max Howard, I didn't know that it was you, Emily Anderson. So I did some research. I figured out that it was indeed you. And then it occurred to me that Max Howard could be either a male name or a female name. And even in the About the Author section at the very back of 15 and Change, there are no gendered pronouns indicating it one way or the other. And so I wondered why you chose Max Howard and if the gender piece crossed your mind at all.
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. It's definitely something I was thinking about. This is my first work for young adults, and so I wanted to use a pen name to distinguish that from work that's written for adults. But I definitely wanted to use a name that wasn't clear about the gender because it makes a really big difference in how you're perceived. There's an organization called VIDA, which tracks the representation of men and women in magazines or in books that are published or how books are reviewed and talked about. And they found really huge inequalities. So I thought, give it a shot. And the name comes from both of my grandfathers, both of whom went by their middle names. So they kind of went by names that weren't their own all their lives.
And again, we can bring you back with well-known authors, George Eliot.
One of my favorites.
Other Georges, George Sand, the Bronte sisters, mm-hmm. all women who wrote under male pen names. I suppose we can move on now to the name of the book itself, 15 and Change. It's about a young boy who gets his first job at a pizza place. Can you describe the main character, Zeke, and his world, his reasons for getting his job at the pizza place, and then also the different meanings that the title 15 and Change might have?
Yeah, Zeke is a young boy. He's almost 15, and he is from a fictitious small town in Wisconsin called Blue Way, and he moves to an unspecified city with his mom when she moves in with a new boyfriend who is not the nicest guy. And Zeke believes that if he can earn some money to help his mom save up, that the two of them can move out and move home to Blue Way. And so he gets a job at a pizza place. And all the time he wants to be just kind of invisible, and he's kind of a shy guy. But at the pizza place, he connects with other people and kind of gets mixed up in the Fight for 15 movement, which is a labor movement that advocates for a $15 minimum wage for workers, often in the food service industry, but also across industries. In advocating for the people that he's working with, he kind of comes into himself. I have to credit my mom. She came up with the title because I was kind of thinking about the Fight for 15 movement, and Zeke is almost 15, and she said 15 and change because he is 15 and he's fighting for change. Also, he's often at a cash register, you know, making change as well.
And the book, you said, is your first for young adults. Can you talk about your target audience? And I'll make the comment, too, that I am an older young adult, I suppose. 28 is probably not your target audience. But reading the book, I found it to be pretty heavy in some of its themes and quite adult, at least compared to what I remember reading when I was in grade school or high school.
Yeah, I think that's really true. I think that often kids today are confronted at a much earlier age with some of the stark realities that are created by the level of income inequality that we have in our communities and in our country. I wanted 15 and Change to be a book that kids could connect with from a variety of backgrounds and could begin to see that the larger social problems that we have, kids can be both impacted by them and have some opportunities to stand up against them or raise their voices or come together around those issues.
That reminds me of your dedication for the book, which is a nod to Emily Dickinson, I think, to her poem, Hope is the Thing with Feathers. And I guess the ending of the book is, I'm not going to give it away, of course, but it's got some happy, good prospects to the end of it. But the style is unusual, I think. I don't recall reading books in verse as a younger adult. Why did you go with verse? And Emily Dickinson, of course, wrote in verse as well, and you referred to your writing in 15 and Change as poems. So can you talk about why you went with that style?
Yeah, definitely. And I'm so glad that Emily Dickinson is part of this conversation. She's been a big inspiration for me, and I really love her work. The novel in verse has been something that's been happening more frequently, especially in young adult novels in the last, I don't know, probably since I was a young adult, right? So in the last 15 years or so. And we're starting to see that more frequently. This particular book is part of a series of books that my publisher is curating that's trying to connect with readers that maybe are more reluctant readers, that maybe have a hard time reading in school for whatever reason or don't like reading. And I think that verse is really having a moment, especially now, not just with people that are reluctant readers, but with people that have the kind of reading habits we all have because of the internet, where it's like short and we're skimming and, you know, don't maybe connect as well with a longer narrative that's more continuous. So this book was written to kind of meet readers where they're at. And I think verse is having a moment. We have a huge poetry explosion in publishing right now. And so it was really fun to have an opportunity to try out the verse novel as a form.
I can relate to that because I have a novel that's traditional form and I got about halfway through it and I haven't touched it since, but I had no trouble reading 15 and change. It's pretty straightforward and I appreciated that a lot. We did talk a little bit about minimum wage and the fight for 15. You have one character, for instance, who's an undercover labor organizer. Olivia is her name, and she organizes the main character, Zeke, and his coworkers who work at the pizza place. How did you get information about how that happens so that you could write about it?
Well, it was a mix of things. I've definitely worked a lot of food service jobs in my life. One of the things that you learn when you're getting a PhD in English is I think it's 65% of college faculty nationwide are part-time, and they are paid very low wages that amounts to close to minimum wage. Recently, I got involved in the labor movement through my work teaching at colleges and wanting to advocate for other college teachers. When I was in Buffalo, New York, in grad school, we stood in solidarity with the Fight for 15 movement there. So it was kind of these amazing events where you would see people who were teachers and people who were working at Burger King or McDonald's all coming together. And to me, that was a really meaningful experience because I think we hear a lot, you have to get an education in order to entitle you to have a decent life. And I think that's really wrong. I think that everyone is entitled to have fair wages for their work, and everyone who works hard should support their family. And this book really came out of this desire to think about what would it be like if we just made a world where that could happen and how could that happen. So I did some research into the kinds of organizing techniques that people are using to help people connect with each other around these labor issues.
One historic throwback you put in there is a reference to Bread and Roses, the labor song, and you've modernized it as a continuation of labor struggles to blood and pizza, I think, for Zeke and his coworkers. I think we definitely have time for you to read something
sure.
from your book if you want. I think that would help give listeners an understanding of why verse as your style, as we already talked about, but the power that it can have in conveying feeling and story. So what would you like to read?
I'd like to read from a section where Zeke is being trained in how to make pizza, and he's being trained by this woman named Mary, and Mary is not a manager, but kind of has an attitude like she is. So there's always a little bit of conflict between Zeke and Mary because Mary is a little bit bossy. So this poem is called, "You've Got to Work on Your Cheese Lock, Mister." "You've got to work on your cheese lock, mister," Mary tells me. She shows me how to build a dam out of shredded cheese to keep pizza sauce from leaking during delivery. Her fingers are red. Her other job is a motel maid. It's hard on the hands. But I can tell sprinkling white cheese makes her happy. It's like a snow globe, she says.
This particular chapter mentions that Mary has a second job, and at some point in the book, Zeke's mother also gets a second job. Both the jobs are on the lower service sector, which I guess speaks to what people have to do just to make ends meet. And Mary is a particularly notable example with what she goes through within the course of the book to take care of her kids and the spiral that's possible if your manager cuts back your hours. And in Mary's case, it was for retaliation. So I found that an interesting character. She keeps her like managerial attitude, or she's still concerned about the company, even though it's not that concerned about her.
Yeah, Mary is one of my favorite characters because she takes so much pleasure in doing a job well and doing things the right way, even though she's treated so poorly by her employers. And that was inspired both by experiences I've had working in food service, and also by, I don't know if you're familiar with Barbara Ehrenreich's book, Nickeled and Dimed in America. It's one of my favorite books that talks about the value and dignity in all kinds of work.
I'm sure there are arguments against raising the minimum wage. I know there are, especially for jobs that are considered to be low skill, like working in fast food, that it should be, I don't know, supply and demand, mm-hmm. or if you're low skilled, you deserve low wages. What do you have to say to those kinds of arguments?
I would have to say that there are really no jobs that are low-skill jobs. Every job I've ever had has had challenges, whether that's dealing with a difficult boss or difficult customers or the actual mechanics of, you know, making a really great pizza, doing so even when there's a huge rush. I think that all jobs require skill and hard work, and that people that are working hard deserve to have an opportunity to feed their families. And there doesn't need to be one single policy solution for that, but we need to have a conversation as a culture about how we can make that happen and make that possible, because it seemed impossible during the bread and roses days, but people came together and made that a possibility so that we could have prosperity.
Well, I think we're coming to the close of our time. It's been too short. So much going on in the book. It's a short book, but there's a lot happening. What can we look for from you in the future? And then, of course, how can listeners find your book, 15 and Change?
Well, right now I'm working on some ideas for chapter books for younger readers about a girl who goes to international schools and goes to different countries. That's like a next project for me. And then you can buy this book in a variety of places. I believe it's available at the local store. You can also find it online.
Well, wonderful. Thank you so much, Emily Anderson, also known as Max Howard, for your time here on Spectrum West.
Thank you so much.
Catherine Thomas making her Spectrum West debut, and we're looking forward to more conversations as topics grab her attention and ours. Thanks, KT. Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio, and support for WPR comes from Art Z Gallery in Amory. December features mixed media artists Julie Adams, Judy Paulson, and Hans Hussman. Fiber artist Loretta Peterson is also featured. ArtZGallery.org. Bill Miller is a Native American singer and writer of songs. He's won awards considered the top in the music business. He's entertained large audiences in iconic big city venues and small gatherings in towns and villages off the beaten path. He's been around a very big block, literally and figuratively. Like most of us, he's had great days and days he'd like to forget. The difference is his experiences find their way into his music. Maybe not in so many words, but certainly in the mood that creates each ballad. Bill Miller's music is heartfelt and diverse like this. It's called The Sun Is Gonna Rise Again from his album Ghost Dance. We'll be talking to Bill Miller in just a second.
There's no reason for fighting this way. There's no rhyme in the words that we say. Don't you know the sun is gonna rise? The sun is gonna rise again. Don't you know the sun is gonna rise? The sun is gonna rise again. There's no beauty in thoughts that betray. There's no peace when your life's gone astray. Don't you know the sun is gonna rise? The sun is gonna rise again. Don't you know the sun is gonna rise? The sun is gonna rise again.
It's tough enough for a young Native American to find his way and his purpose in the midst of sometimes hardship and sometimes discrimination. It might be even harder to find something like music within all that periodic turmoil. Or, here's my other take on music to you. You, quote-unquote, discovered music, and it turned out to be just what your young life needed. Tell me how warm I am on that.
Well, the discovery of music, it was there on the reservation and in the cities. We moved back and forth from the reservation to the city. My dad was going to electronics school. And then when I got into these grade schools, I was hearing what the kids were listening to then. We were listening to the same thing on the reservation on AM radios. It was like there was, at that age, there was no wall for me to climb over, at least for me, as far as a race issue or even saying that Indians don't listen to the blues. You can't listen to B.B. King, Bill. You can't listen to Barbra Streisand. You can't listen to Bing Crosby. You can't listen to, you know, Frank Sinatra, who was on the radio with Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin at the time.
Yeah.
I was listening. I can tell you the exact stations I was listening to before I left the res, and they were these stations. They were WSM, you know, the Grand Opry in Nashville, which now are my initials, the English name. I have William S. Miller Scott. But I loved WSM. I would hear these stories and laughter and fiddles and great country music. The other stations were Chicago, WLS, and WCFL.
You bet.
They were big, and then there was one in Arkansas I heard.
I can tell you the one in Arkansas, K-A-A-Y.
That's it. That's it. That's the station. So those stations drove me into a new world where I never wanted to be. People don't believe me, but I never wanted to be a musician. It helped me through the hardest of times to take my guitar as a young kid and to try and play along with old Beatles songs, Rolling Stones, and then eventually Michael Nesmith playing Joanne.
Mm-hmm.
I learned that in high school. Her name was Joanne, and I'd play with it and I'd sing, and I realized I could sing. But I was afraid to sing to the Beatles because I didn't sound like Paul or George. I was just a little nerd in the 60s.
Okay.
But by the 70s, I had a voice, and then I started to find certain people that fit my intonation and all that I have. It was the radio that helped me find my intonation. It was the radio messages that helped me see into the future. It was the radio that I heard Martin Luther King's speech on. It was the radio that I heard bits and pieces of War and Peace. And it was the radio that I eventually got on public radio that got me into the whole scene of recording and even touring. So it was a great effect for me when I realized that. I was like, wow, I'm going out, man. And the reservation had its limitations to, as far as, like, I knew all my relatives. I knew all the woods, the rivers, and all that, and it was great. It was lovely to be there. But when I went to Milwaukee, the world changed. I was like, holy cow, man, this is as diverse as it gets for me. I never met so many people, ate so many different kinds of food. It was then the world changed. Then I heard blues for real being played. I heard folk music, festivals. Pete Seeger and Odetta for the first time in my life. That was the first big show I heard that knocked me back. Banjo and a beautiful black woman singing from her soul.
Uh-huh.
It blew my freaking mind, to be honest with you. Then I met Arlo Guthrie and Richie Havens literally 6 months after that. And then I was like, wow, they took me on the road. And then I started writing songs. I met Michael Murphy. Wildfire took me on the road. John Prine. Hmm. It just kept going up the ladder. And I ended up touring with a lot of friends of mine, including Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. I'm still friends with those guys. I love them. And they all encouraged me to come to Nashville. And I took my family down there. The rest is history.
What about the guitar? How did you become proficient on that?
My dad got me a guitar from an Antigo hack shop or something. He had used everything, and he brought me this Japanese fake Fender guitar. So I picked it up at 9, and I was playing electric till I was 15, and I ended up getting an acoustic guitar from one of my cousins who played in a polka band in Oshkosh, and I used to play rhythm with those guys. And then I never took a lesson. I was proficient at it. I just picked up on it easily.
We're talking with Bill Miller, three-time Grammy winner, recording artist, painter, activist, guitar, flute player. He is, by the way, a special guest on the Big River Radio Wave show coming up statewide on Wisconsin Public Radio. Christmas Eve Day, it's going to be aired at 9 a.m. and then on Christmas Day at 7 p.m. Catch that if you can. I was there, and Bill killed it, as they say. I was going to say something about people sometimes mellow as they age. You know, their energy for causes diminishes, and they're not as fervent in their support of things as they once were. I'm not getting that vibe from you.
Well, I do have as much passion for the causes and life, and music has driven that, but I don't like to use music as a political standpoint in my art. You know, a lot of people do that. And that's great. I don't want to be just, like Dylan would say that. He doesn't just want to be a protest singer. He happens to sing songs, and if they're fitting into that thing, that's the way I am too. But what I have found in my later years is that through a lot of tragedy, and let me go back a bit. When I was in art school, that's why I went to college for, actually, and that's what I got my degree in is the arts.
Ah.
When I was in art school, one of my teachers in the freshman year at Layton School of Art and Design asked the class, "When do you guys think you're going to be a true artist?" And one girl raised her hand, and she said, "Well, when I get my degree." "You mean your bachelor's degree?" She goes, "Yeah, okay." "When do you think?" This guy says, "When I get my master's, I'll be an artist." And the other guy said, "My doctorate." "Really? Is that you? You all think that?" And we said, "Yeah." He said, "You're all wrong, man." He said, "You don't become a true artist till you're in your 50s and 60s and even 70s, because you have to live life and bleed the colors you put on the canvas and sculpt the stones throughout your life. You're going to have to live life to be a true artist." And I never forgot that. And I've lived enough life in my years to realize that the passion only makes me more, not competitive at all. The competitive spirit left me. It left me like 10 years ago. The only person I compete against is myself, which I have to accept and love myself. But the compassion I have for humanity and the human race has gone up. Compassion I have for my children, life, music, just people in general, it has magnified.
Cool.
Therefore, when I get on a stage, I can hardly control myself at certain songs when I'm singing it, because I'm not thinking, "Oh my God, that's going to be the next hit. I'm going to knock this guy off the charts. I'm going to sell a million records." It's not in my language, and it won't ever be. It has to be. This touched my heart when I wrote it, and it made a good friend of mine, you know, lips quiver and cry. This has got to have some power to it. Something's with this thing. And sometimes when I write a song like that, I'm afraid to share it. I don't know what'll come up, but I have to tell myself, "You got to let go, Bill. Tell the story behind the song and put it out there and see what happens." And it's a healing part. You know, my instruments used to be instruments of rock and roll. When I was 19, I was in a rock band. I had a Les Paul and Marshall Stack, and you wore black leather pants, and you were rocking in a bar.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an instrument to you know, to be a, whatever, a wannabe posing rock star. But I'm not like that. My guitar is an instrument of peace. My flutes are an instrument of peace. My voice is an instrument of peace. I don't want to incite war or to make people march down and burn the house down, mm-hmm. even if I don't agree with them politically. And yeah. I don't want to do that. I really don't. Because I think the bigger thing is to find peace and reconciliation within a process with people that you extremely cannot get along with, you don't agree with, and to try and find a common ground, because war and fighting these people, it just makes it worse.
I'm guessing that what you've been talking about for the last minute or two maybe segues into Bill Miller, the public speaker, because that's one thing you're pretty well known for as well. A little bit inspirational, I would think. You've spoken to corporate audiences, large, small.
Yeah, and I didn't expect to do that either. And one time I was speaking at a concert, and one of the doctors from a medical university heard me and said, "Will you come to our university and speak?" And that's how it all started. I never considered myself a public speaker, but I am, and I'm glad to do it now. It takes as much effort, if not even more, to speak than it does to sing. I have to tell you that right now. It's a different vibe. It's not to say, when I see these great public speakers, they're rock stars. It's not about being a rock star. It's about placing your subject matter in a place where it's under a light and people can see it. It's like painting, too. It's like some of my paintings and some of the old paintings I've studied, they were painted to be seen under candlelight or gaslight in the old days, you know, and it gave them a golden glow, not to be in bright fluorescent lights, you know, or sunlight. You know
sure.
what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
So when a speaker speaks, I think some people need to realize that woman speaking about you know, trauma, or the Vietnam vet speaking about post-traumatic stress, or I'm speaking about Native history and trauma, or whatever I'm addressing for this corporate thing. I try to put it under a light. And the good news is I'm a visual artist and I'm a musician. I think it helps my presentation because I bring in art and music into wherever I speak.
You know, for songwriters, the rear view mirror produces a whole bunch of music and lyrics oftentimes. You're writing music now? And if so, what are you writing about these days?
Well, I am writing. I'm working on stuff for a new project I've been working on for the past year with John Carter Cash. And when I first started, it was just exciting. We've been writing 100 songs or more together for years, and we thought we'd put a few of those on. But to me, I was like, well, John, they're great songs. I've moved on beyond that. And what really changed me this past couple of years was when my son was killed, my oldest son from my first marriage, and he was a songwriter. And it isn't like I write depressing songs. That's not what I'm saying. But I noticed that I was writing differently than I did before he passed away. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
Life changes happen, and then my music amped up. So I'm writing from a point of view again. And I normally do, but this album, these songs are stenographer pinpointed, meaning I consider myself a lot of times as a stenographer on life. I take notes. Mm-hmm. I listen to things. I really do. A lot of people do and don't. They listen because they're nosy, because they're jerks, or they want to get ahead, or they want an idea on something. I've had people, musicians, I don't know if they're real musicians, but they're spying on me. Look how I write lyrics. They sit up on stage and watch how I play a chord or an open tuning. And I'm not negative, but they're looking at it. But I don't watch to get ahead, you know? I don't look like, oh, my God, how did that guy build that? How did he meet that girl? Or, good God, how did that go? No, that's not what I'm doing. I'm just taking notes, and I'm learning about life. And I literally write it down or take my iPhone, and I say, I just heard this from this elderly Hispanic man in a Goodwill, mm-hmm. and it blew my mind. That's the way I write.
I need you to help me out, though. How can we say happy holidays in your native tongue? Give us a way to greet each other that proves that we were here.
See, this is, I think this is Delaware more than Mohican, but mache lenda, and it means keep it holy, keep it sacred.
Mache lenda.
Yeah.
Well, Bill Miller, mache lenda back at you. Thanks so much for being with us on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're looking forward to your performance on the Big River Radio Wave, and I would appreciate it if you keep in touch.
I will do. I love Wisconsin Public Radio, and again, I ask your listeners to support it because I've supported it in my ways. My first big thing on, I opened a station in Hayward, WOJV Radio. I was the first one to sing on that radio station in a gymnasium up there. Hmm. And it's great to be personally involved with our radio. They're the only stations, people, if you're listening to me right now, that involve humanity and you, Wisconsin people, and they care about you. They're not commercial-based. They're for the, you know, the earth and for the land and politics and everything involved. But I wouldn't be who I am without public radio. That's all I got to say.
Well, you also have had quite a relationship with radio. Stories of years ago. I mean, it's kind of got you into music.
Yeah.
All right, Bill. Safe travels. Thanks again.
You're welcome.
Can see. I want to go where the lame will walk. I want to see the sick ones clean, where the deaf can hear and the silent talk. Where are you going? To a ghost dance in the snow. I'm chase defeat. Where there's nothing done except that can't be forgiven. Every step you take is on sacred ground. Walk away from death to the land of the living. Where all the lost tribes are finally found. I said, where are you going? To a ghost dance in the snow. I am a mighty warrior. And I'm finally coming home. I said, where are you going? To a ghost dance.
That's Bill Miller, ladies and gentlemen. You can learn all about him at his website, billmiller.co, and there are a bunch of YouTube videos as well. Mache Lenda. And remember, the Big River Radio Wave airs statewide on Wisconsin Public Radio, and I was mistaken during the show when I said 9 a.m. because it's 8 a.m. on Christmas Eve Day, the 24th. So forget 9 a.m. It's 8 a.m. Monday, the 24th, and then Christmas Day at 7 p.m. Hey, thanks to Kate for shouting out and Dean for putting up with. Thank you for being the audience every program needs. We're going to take off next week for the holiday. Here's hoping yours is wonderful, as in full of wonder. For Catherine Thomas and Jim Oliver, here it comes. I love this. See you next year.